11% of Americans over 12 years old take some form of antidepressant medication. According to the CDC, 1 in 10 adults report being depressed. Depression is a mental disorder that is more severe than just sad feelings. It can last long periods of time, including feelings of hopelessness and uselessness, cause chronic pain, headaches, sleeping and eating disorders, thoughts of suicide, and can make day-to-day life seem pointless or impossible to handle. Good morning and welcome to Central Standard on KCUR. I am Suzanne Hogan, and this morning we're talking about depression with Dr. Bruce Lease, a psychologist at KU Medical Center, who joins us every so often to offer perspective, understanding, and advice about the human psyche. Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning. Good to see you this morning.
Yeah, nice to see you. So let's start first by defining what is depression and how is it different from just feeling sad?
Well, you did a good job there initially introducing it. You hit on most of the important criteria. It is different from sadness because it's more severe, it's more chronic, it's more overwhelming. It does involve feelings of sadness and despair. But in some people, it also presents as anxiety or anger or irritability or frustration. So the biggest difference from sadness, the mood is the same to a large extent, but the biggest difference is that it tends to be debilitating. It gets in the way of everything.
When people come to see you in your office, do you find it hard for them to understand whether or not they're depressed or sad? Like, is that a hard thing for individually to understand?
It's interesting. People don't easily talk about vulnerable feelings. We in our society in the United States don't generally talk about vulnerable feelings. I'm in a medical center practicing predominantly with physicians, so I get a lot of referrals from people who have physical symptoms, can't sleep, they're tired, their appetite has changed, things like aches and pains. You mentioned those in the introduction. That's really what a lot of people present with. And, men more than women don't even report any feelings. They just say they're not the same because they don't feel the same. So a lot of different presentations of depression.
Are some people sometimes surprised with their diagnosis?
Yeah. The surprising thing to me is that some people so don't want to be diagnosed with depression. They say to the doctor, the physician, it couldn't be that, run more tests. It's got to be something different. There's a certain stigma associated with depression so that, some people may be surprised. I have had that. People saying, really? Is that what depression is? But again, a lot of people show a lot of other symptoms that they want to know what's the physical, non-psychological, non-brain cause.
Why do you think that stigma exists?
We are a nation of people who's competitive. We're competitive. There's a lot of striving. There's not a lot of tolerance of pain and suffering. And I think one of the biggest reasons why we don't show our vulnerabilities is because most normal people, regular people out on the street, don't know how to deal with people who say, I'm really sad. I'm having a tough day. Most people just don't know what to say. They come up speechless.
Yeah, it's like if somebody says, how are you? And you really answer how you're feeling. People don't know how to respond, But everybody in their life experiences these ups and downs. And what ways do you work with patients to kind of determine whether it's a natural down point that will pass or it's something that needs medication and therapy?
Each of these questions is so good. I want to say that's a good question. That's a good question. That's a good question. Because each one is a really, really good question. So what I look for, I think, is what your question is. Sometimes it's just the demeanor. Sometimes it's expressed nonverbally. People can be slowed in their speech. They can have difficulty concentrating. I really like to bring in family members as much as possible. And my biggest role, I think, at KU Med is to train physicians, and I recommend to them that they bring in family. If you have a spouse, ask the spouse to bring in the spouse, and you get that kind of background data, and you ask for changes in mood. And the biggest thing I look for is interruptions in normal everyday living. Just interruptions like I don't want to go to work anymore. I don't really want to spend time with friends. I don't want to get out of bed. Those kinds of significant changes. And I also look for timeline. How long has this been going on?
So there are different kinds of depression, though. Can you describe some of those and what are the different symptoms of those?
Sure. It's interesting that the news that we just listened to before we came on air was about the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. I just got back from a meeting in Washington where that was the purpose of the meeting, to discuss that diagnostic manual. That manual defines mental disorders, all of the thought disorders like schizophrenia and thought disorders like paranoid, paranoia, stuff like that. But it also defines what's called affective disorders, affective, affective disorders. And major depressive episodes are under affective disorders, but so is bipolar illness, also known as manic depressive illness. So a depressive disorder is an episode of 2 weeks or more of really debilitating sadness that affects most every body part. A manic episode is kind of the opposite. It's speeding up. It's feeling like you can't turn your motor off. So manic depressive illness or bipolar illness is the up and down, the strong, intense ups and downs. And it's usually an episodic. It could last for a few days, for a couple of weeks. Whereas another disorder, depressive disorder, is dysthymia. That's kind of a, the character Eeyore? That's the Eeyore character. You know, kind of never has a lot of energy, never really in a good mood. If you say, how are you doing today? They go, okay. So then there's postpartum depression, which isn't a separate diagnostic category. It's part of depression. It's being looked at as a separate entity, but it isn't yet one officially in the diagnostic manual. And they're changing grieving so that it is treated differently. It is treated as depression if all of the symptoms are reached.
And you mean treated with medication then?
Anything that's considered a legitimate, empirically tested treatment. It could be medication. One of the legitimate treatments of depressive disorders is a regular routine of exercise, improved diet. A good clinician will check on all those things. Are you eating well? Are you getting out and taking care of your body? Stuff like that. Depression tends to be a very cyclic process. A person thinks depressed thoughts that may be triggered by a biochemical change in their body, a neurotransmitter or brain change. So, it's not important what comes first, whether it's changes in brain activity or changes in thinking or changes just in mood. But mood changes, behaviors then change, thinking changes, biology changes, and it all reinforces a kind of a spiraling down. And so really that's a lot of how depression even manifests and occurs and continues itself.
So there's all these different kinds of depression and they have different characteristics. But do we know initially what causes depression, what's going on in our brain?
Yeah, we do. We know that it is multifaceted. Very few people would argue that. Anyone who argues that there's no neurotransmitter biochemical processes related is absolutely wrong, because everything we think and everything we do is a function of how our neurotransmitters work. So there's a strong biological basis, which would result from genetic differences potentially or changes in lifestyle. So there's a genetic component. There is a biochemical component. The way people think largely determines how they feel. So thought processes that are negative and nihilistic and involve perhaps self-hate, self-criticism, that can lead to depression. So that could be a cause. And changes in the environment, severe losses, profound losses, losses of things that mean a lot to people can result in depression. So best way to look at it, multifactorial, multifaceted causes.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Suzanne Hogan. We're talking about depression, the symptoms and treatment options with Dr. Bruce Leese. We'd like to hear from you. Have you been through a depressive episode? What was it that helped you get through it? Join our conversation at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or send us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org. So we mentioned earlier that 11% of Americans over 12 years old take some form of medication for depression. How do you determine what kind of medications to give a patient? Because there's so many out there.
Right. When I started, I do need to say that as a PhD psychologist, I myself don't prescribe. But most psychologists I know that treat depression really need to know what the medicines are, at least, and need to understand the impacts of those medications. So I can speak as a psychologist seeing people with depression, not a prescriber. So when I started, there were very few. They called them tricyclic antidepressants, and that was many years ago, 30 years ago. And over time, they've come up with different types that affect different neurotransmitters. I believe that most physicians who prescribe prescribe SSRIs, and to the extent that they are effective, the patient stays on them. If there are side effects that become intolerable, then they'll try one with different side effects. And to some extent, the way to know a drug is working, an antidepressant, is if there are some side effects, then you know at least the patient's getting a dose that's affecting them. But physicians do a good job of monitoring what are your side effects, what are what are the symptoms, is this alleviating them, and so the decision is made based on the diagnosis, then the severity of the diagnosis. Is it depression? How severe is it? There's a term, vegetative symptoms. The vegetative symptoms are the ones that make it impossible for the person to function. That's a good time for a physician to prescribe antidepressants. And part of the decision-making process, if a person is so depressed that they can hardly function, then they won't respond as well to psychotherapy. So the combination of antidepressants for vegetative symptoms and then psychotherapy, that's an optimal combination.
Well, and it seems like so many of the side effects for some of these drugs look like symptoms of depression too. So even just finding the right match of what works for a person can need some therapy. Do you experience that with patients who are trying to find the right balance of what medications they should be taking? And
that's a very good question, and I really mean that. I find that patients have preferences. That some people will go to their doctor and say, give me something to take for my depression, while other people say, I don't want to take any medicine. So I think that the job of the clinician, both physician and psychologist, social worker, et cetera, the counselor, I think our job as professional mental health care workers is to find that right balance. I don't prescribe. But if somebody comes to me and my therapy is not working because they have too many vegetative symptoms, it's really my job to say, I think you need to see a physician in order to get the medication. So there's usually either a great aversion or a great hope for medicine in individuals who are depressed.
How has society and the medical community kind of evolved over time and since you've been working in the way that it looks at treating depression and diagnosing and treating?
An interesting study took place a while back. It was reported in the Atlantic Monthly. And in that article, there was a study presented from the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. They looked at 55,639 subjects, and they found that depression was being overdiagnosed. So they took this group of over 5,000 people between 2009 and 2010, and they after they were diagnosed and they were treated, these researchers interviewed them. A lot of people they interviewed, and they asked them about their symptoms. And as it turned out, their symptoms were not adequate to reach the full diagnostic level. So I bet a lot of those people were treated with antidepressants, even though they didn't reach or exceed that threshold of depression. I think some clinicians, some prescribing clinicians, will give antidepressants when they can't, when they don't really know what's going on and they think some mood change exists. So, you know, that 11% you said is way more than the prevalence of – it's twice the prevalence of depression. 11% of people are taking antidepressants. Only 5.6 or 6.7% of people have depression. So not only is depression being overdiagnosed, but it's also probably being overtreated.
And then – so what's the harm there, do you think, for people that maybe they start to – think that just taking a pill can solve the problems, and maybe there's some lifestyle changes that can be made, or changes in our society in the way that we look at, you know, quality of life that can maybe improve happiness.
One of the most widely read books in history, in the history of popular literature, is M. Scott Peck's book *Road Less Traveled*, and the first line of that book was "Life is difficult." I believe that most of us mortals underestimate how difficult life is, navigating daily challenges, life-changing challenges. To the extent that we aren't prepared for that navigational process where we learn to cope, to the extent that we're not prepared, some people go to a doctor and say, "I'm sick." In fact, it's not sickness. It's life is difficult. Ideally, people figure out that because life is difficult, it's important to generate and create and come up with really good skills for dealing with life, interpersonal skills, vocational skills. So those skills help us cope so that we don't feel depressed in those people who are in that category of the overdiagnosed.
We're talking to Bruce Leese. This is Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Suzanne Hogan, and we're going to hear from you. When you're sad or feeling down, how do you get through those times? Give us a call, 816-235-2888. We're tweeting at KCURCST. Let's hear from Robert. Robert, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I, in college, ended up with the depression anxiety component. I was able to function and found out years later the anxiety component was still there. I was one of those people, no drugs for me. And found EMDR. Is there any sort of eye movement desensitization reprogramming for those who don't know what that is? Has that been studied into depression to help those neurotransmitters reconnect in a more effective way, more productive way?
All right. Thanks, Robert. Bruce, so EMDR, what is
yes,
that?
Yes. You're absolutely correct. EMDR. I'm not gonna say what it stands for because I know I'll get it wrong because I wasn't really thinking about EMDR. But EMDR has been carefully, widely studied. I've never heard anything negative about it in the scientific literature. It's been called a form of cognitive behavioral therapy, which is the most validated of all the therapies. Actually, that's not true. It's just among the top ones that have been validated. It does train people to think differently and to focus themselves differently and to understand better what's going on for them. I am quite certain it's been found effective for the treatments of both depression and anxiety. But there is a strong cognitive behavioral component to it, which means people learn to change the way they think. And they learn to change certain kinds of behaviors that are not adaptive, and as a result, they get good outcomes. So,
can you give examples? I'm still having a hard time.
I know. Understanding I'm not an EMDR.
Robert, are you still with us?
I am.
Great. Why don't you explain it?
All right. Well, my experience, we actually found that the roots of it were actually back in early childhood with a death of a grandparent, and you begin trying to find those places where you have very stark memories, and you begin just kind of working with them and see what works out. While your eyes follow back and forth a light bar, I know there are more extreme measures where there are actual electrical prods put on patients so that it does take their attention away. And the idea is that it activates your left brain and right brain to think about the issue at the same time. You just sit there and you watch this light bar while thinking about this. And my therapist was quite good at noticing if I was like retreating and trying to make sure that you don't get caught up in that, but that you remain absolutely present while.
Is it almost like an act of meditation in some
ways?
Yeah,
I was going to say that. The newest wave of therapies is actually integrating. It's actually integrating mindfulness techniques and meditation, and using those terms. And Suzanne, that was a very good point. EMDR uses what even sounds like a little bit of kind of hypnotic functioning in the eye movement, etc. But making people more mindful of what they think and what they feel in any given moment, how they respond to memories, which are thoughts, anything that increases mindfulness in constructive ways and then helps people to understand what to do with that mindfulness is likely to be effective therapy. And again, this, the newest wave of cognitive behavioral therapies, I just did a chapter on this, the newest wave of cognitive behavioral therapies does now include a lot of mindfulness training. ACT therapy is one of them, capital A, capital C, capital T. Acceptance and commitment therapy gets people to think more mindfully. These are all subsets of cognitive and behavioral therapies.
And we found out EMDR stands for eye movement desensitization and reprocessing.
Do you see why I didn't want to say what
we got? So I want to talk about some of these other alternative treatments or that you hear about. There's a lot of lists on the internet if you're just looking for help. You know, try getting your hands dirty, more sunlight, St. John's Wort, all these kind of natural remedies for depression. And I want to know your opinion about those. Are they effective?
First and foremost, if you're going to put anything in your body that isn't a normal nutrient that you can pluck off a tree or buy in a store, anything that's touted as a supplement should definitely be checked with a physician, because people don't realize that you can overdose on things that are like niacin. That people take huge doses of niacin, and anything that you put into your body should be checked first with a physician for their approval, given your chemistry, etc. Because physicians stay on top of that stuff. And anything that involves healthy exercise or healthy thinking is absolutely positively going to improve a person's life and help them with depression. Anything that sounds too good to be true is too good to be true. Because as I said earlier, like the first line of M. Scott Peck's book, life is difficult and there aren't any really simple answers.
No quick fix.
No quick fixes. So, and St. John's Wort, I just looked at a review of St. John's Wort. That was popular years back. But again, you know, unless a physician says, I'm recommending that you take this, I recommend against putting anything in your body unusual that your physician hasn't approved of.
Because everybody's affected by everything differently and the
exactly.
consequences. So let's talk about kids and diagnosing kids. I'm wondering, what's the earliest or youngest patient you've ever seen for depression?
Oh, you know, I start actively seeing children who've gotten well into elementary school, you know, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old. Typically what I do is I will talk to parents who are concerned about their children, and I will first interview the parents and see what's going on at home. And if they say, oh, we have a wonderful home, we only, you know, we bicker, but it's always kind of friendly bickering. And I ask what's friendly, and they say, you know, and they describe it. And I think, oh, my God, this would make any kid depressed to watch their parents argue like this. Then I'll work with the parents, and I will not even think about the child's so-called depression unless it sounds like it's severe, moderate to severe. So a lot of times with children, I'll start with the parents and realize I don't need to see the children. More often I'll see the parent. And then parents, and then I'll see the children. And if the parent's behavior doesn't seem to be triggering troubling thoughts for the child, you know, that I'll feel comfortable seeing somebody starting with adolescence, 11, 12, 13 years old. I think that's within my purview. But there are children far younger than that seem very depressed and are at risk for suicide, and they really need to go to pediatric or child specialists who can really do a full evaluation.
How are symptoms in young children different from adults?
Well, they're not they are not as articulate as adults. Children are very concrete. Until well into adolescence, children don't master abstract concepts. So they can't tell you that they feel helpless and describe helplessness. They can't say, like, helplessness is an abstract concept. It's not like table or chair, which is concrete. They may describe mommy hit daddy, or daddy hit mommy, but they can't explain, and that made me have less faith in humanity. So, they manifest it with sad appearances, withdrawal, not doing as well at things that they normally will have done well at. Children figure out how to do damage to themselves at a very young age when they're depressed. So it's important that children whose behaviors look depressed be evaluated carefully by pediatrician, child psychiatrist, child psychologist, etc.
And then kind of moving on into the teen years, where there are so many other natural ups and downs that are happening. A kid who's been depressed before would carry a lot of baggage into those years. But then there's also a lot of children who are just kind of experiencing a lot of different hormones and feeling different angst and anxiety and stress. What kind of advice do you offer for parents who are trying to value the mental health of their teens and kids as they're coming of age?
I would recommend the parents start well before that and teach their children words that describe feelings. A lot of parents don't understand the importance of teaching children the difference between sadness and anger and worry and tense and anxious and all those. Teach children to communicate with feeling words so that as they get older, they can describe how they feel. There's no magical or genetic transference of the ability to communicate or articulate. There's nothing magical about kids learning how to talk about their feelings. They have to be taught to talk about their feelings. So if you start early and a kid is struggling, the kid will be able to say, I'm really angry at my friend. Or of course I feel hurt that my girlfriend's going out with my best friend. Of course I'm mad and I'm really, really upset. So they need to learn to talk about feelings. But if you haven't taught your kid feelings, look for behavior changes, look for drops in their grades, stuff like that. Adolescents and teenagers don't automatically get upset when they're teenagers. Something else might be going on.
We're going to take a break. When we return, we'll continue our conversation about depression with Dr. Bruce Leese, our regular Central Standard visiting psychologist. Have you been through a depressive episode? What was it that helped you get through it? We'd like to hear from you. Give us a call, 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. I'm Suzanne Hogan. Central Standard will return in just a moment. Good morning and welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Suzanne Hogan. According to the CDC, you are more likely to meet criteria for major depression if you're between 45 and 64 years old, have less than a high school education, have been previously married, are unable to work or unemployed, Black, Latino, or of mixed multiple races, or a person without health insurance coverage. We're talking about depression with Bruce Leese, our resident psychologist here on Central Standard, on how to better understand this mental health disorder that affects nearly 1 in 10 Americans. Thanks for joining us this morning, Bruce.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
We'd like to hear from you. Have you ever been diagnosed with depression? Did you or do you take medication for it? Or have you tried alternative therapies? What worked for you? Join the conversation at 816-235-2888 or send us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org. So that number, that ages between 64 earlier, excuse me, that seems kind of later in life to me for a diagnosis. And I'm wondering what kind of things are going on in people's life that might call for that to be kind of diagnosed later on.
I'm very interested in lifespan development, kind of stages of life. And I normally don't think of that group either as the most depressed group. Throughout the course of life, we're expected to, and we sort of do, aim for different things. You know, if you're an adolescent, you aim to be, you know, the cutest, most attractive, funniest person in your high school. If you're, you know, just out of school, you're really aiming to be successful in your career and in new relationships, possibly marriage. Then in your 30s, you're expected to kind of gain mastery. I think my experience with people in those age groups is that they're very busy trying to achieve what they're supposed to achieve. At 45, mid-40s, people start to look back and ask themselves, you know, am I who I thought I would be at this age? And have I succeeded at what I thought I was going to do with my life? At 45, people are less optimistic about starting a new career. So I think the level of unhappiness probably doesn't change nearly as much as a person's focus at a different stage of life. So that's what you might call a midlife crisis. 45 years old is clearly entry and beyond middle age. If you think of middle age as half of your lifespan, 45 is half of 90. And if we're healthy, it's a miracle to live to be 90 years old. So I'm guessing that the reason why those numbers come out the way they do, those ages, is because people in middle age asking, what have I done with my life? And that's the time where you stop saying, well, maybe I'll try a new job. Maybe I'll try a new spouse. It gets a little late in life for that. So,
do you think that expectations and the standards that society puts on people at this age, you know, it may be a little high?
It's interesting. We internalize those standards. Those standards are very real. They exist out there in society. But until we impose those standards on ourselves, like, you know, I thought I'd be the president of my company. I thought I'd own a company. I thought I'd be, you know, a full professor. I thought I'd be the mayor of my town. Whatever you think, whatever your standards are, I thought I'd be handsomer, prettier than I was. I thought I'd get a better spouse. Those standards, unless they're internalized, aren't going to cause too many problems. But once we internalize them, they can be problematic if they're not realistic or achievable.
So what type of treatment do you suggest for somebody that's coming into this? You know, there's medication, obviously, but what kind of therapy, day-to-day lifestyle advice do you have for people?
Mindfulness is such a good recommendation for anyone. Mindfulness is, and we even did a show on this, I think a couple of years ago here on Central Standard. Mindfulness is becoming more attuned, attentive, aware of, in touch with who we are and who we want to be and in the moment. So it's a way of assessing how things are going internally instead of just randomly jumping from activity to activity. So increased mindfulness, looking at one's own goals, relationships are really high on my list of treatments. A good therapy will look at a person's relationships, whether even if it's medicine. If I were a prescribing doctor instead of a talk doctor, I would regardless, I would look at people's relationships. How's your marriage? How are your relationships with your kids? If you're not married, who do you love and how well are you loved? So therapies and self-therapy should include an awareness of who one is and who they want to be and whether that's realistic or achievable and how to get there. And then, of course, integrating how I get along with everyone around me.
Let's talk about some issues that are facing women specifically who are 70% more likely to experience depression than men. What do you think? Where do you think this number comes from? Does it include postpartum depression?
Absolutely. Postpartum depression, 7 to 13% of depressed people, I believe, somewhere in that number or inclusive of those numbers, experience postpartum depression. It's a combination of the hormonal changes of being pregnant and giving birth, particularly giving birth, and the adjustment to that hormonally, and also the life-changing processes of having a child. But clearly, the majority of women over men who are diagnosed with depression has a lot to do with the acceptability of women saying, I am sad, I am not happy, I don't feel good about myself. We still have many men, if not most men in our society, that believes it's taboo to admit to vulnerability. I just talked to a woman today, and I said, you're very fortunate to be a woman in that, you know, you talk to your friends the way you just told me you talk to your friends. How do you feel? Who do you care about? Who cares about you? Men don't do that in the locker room or on the job as often.
We're going to take a call from James in Midtown. James, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi. I just wanted to talk for a minute about, like, the prevalence of depression in high schoolers, because I suffered through it myself, and I'm in high school. I'm 17, and I've noticed that a lot of the people that I go to high school with, especially the kids who have the most pressure put on them from whether it's, like, parents or just, like, maybe older siblings or something, are the ones who then exhibit a lot of the signs of depression. And it's a lot of the high schoolers that have to deal with all that pressure to live up to.
James, thanks so much for the call. Bruce?
I have a lot of a substantial part of my practice is actually adolescents, people in high school. And I believe that James is right. I believe that that the emotions of adolescence are more intense than at any other time in a person's life. A lot of desires and hopes and wants and needs exist, and the need to be part of a group, the pressures of academia, those are all very, very, very intense. And I think people numb out to them or habituate to them or get distracted by work after high school. College is a lot easier socially than high school. So everything he said was right. I can say that teenagers, the prevalence of diagnosed depression is not higher in teenagers than in other groups. You just proved that by talking about that 42 to 64-year-old group. So, but it's just a very difficult time. And to the extent that family is supportive, that parents are listening, that parents understand what's going on, to the extent that teachers and counselors at school connect with kids and say, I know what you're going through. I watched it. You know, I watched your friends sitting next to you for most of this year, and then all of a sudden they've all kind of moved to the other side of the room, and you must feel lousy. To the extent that teachers, educators, people involved in the educational process, parents, neighbors, the extent that people pay attention to kids' struggles, teenagers, really helps a lot.
We're talking with Bruce Lease, psychologist in the Department of Family Medicine at KU Medical Center. We're going to hear now from Richard in Brookside. Richard, good morning.
Hi. Thanks for having this discussion. I was diagnosed with depression several years ago. It's actually 6 years ago when I went through the death of my last parent, to whom I was very close, and a rather painful and separation divorce all in about a span of 4 to 5 months. And so I did definitely go into a debilitating depression, ended up on medication, and eventually felt like I came out of it, and I just quit the medication cold turkey after about 6 months and relied on exercise and activity and stuff. But my question is, I've read about what's called low-level depression, I guess, or
dysthymia.
Recurring.
Yeah, dysthymia.
Pardon?
It's called dysthymia, that kind of low-level depression that follows some people around for years of their lives. D-Y-S-T-H. I think it's D-I. I can't spell it. D-Y-S-T-H-Y-M-I-A, I think it is. I don't get to write it too much.
We'll have our producer, Matthew, check. But, Richard, continue with your question.
Yeah, well, I just wonder, you know, how... Because I have read also that depression is actually physically damaging. It's damaging to your brain and to areas of your brain if it's left untreated. And I just wondered how damaging that low level is. My therapist, when I had a therapist, told me once that people that don't get proper therapy, sometimes when they do eventually come out of it, they kind of feel like they've been in a fog for a long time, or like they've been asleep and have just woken up, and I'm concerned about that low level depression, because I sort of feel like I have it just down there below the surface and it's just kind of rumbling along. And I've read about, you know, artists and famous people that have had their cases publicized, that they suffer from bouts of depression throughout their lives sometimes, or, and I wonder how debilitating that is, if it's detrimental to your mind, and should you continue to get therapy for it, or is there some way to really even tell if you have it?
Richard, thanks so much. I'm glad to hear you're feeling better. Bruce?
Sure. I am going to agree with what you were told, but let me explain, because I think that's really important. It's not like cancer where cells start to grow and they're going to take over your brain and there'll be no turning back. Every word that's coming out of my mouth right now, everything I'm doing is happening because my brain is functioning. And there are certain things that have become habit, like sitting in front of this microphone now after 3 years. There are patterns of connections in the brain that result from learning. To the extent that you learn something really, really well, your brain has made an adjustment that could very well become permanent. You know, knowing how to drive a car is probably something very permanent that will be locked into your brain forever. So knowing that there's a biochemical component of depression, and knowing that learning affects the brain profoundly, and we've learned so much through brain imaging about how the brain changes with learning. If you continually think negative, despairing, pessimistic thoughts, if you continually do that for years and years and years, even at a low level, there are changes going on in your brain, but they're not kind of exotic, mysterious changes. It's you're habituating, you're making bad thinking such a habit that it's going to be difficult to undo the longer it goes on. So, it's not like cancer where there's something growing. It's more that the connections are falling into place in such a way that you just don't want them to fall into place. There's a whole new way of – there's a school of thinking in psychology that began about 15, 20 years ago called positive psychology. And there's a book, I believe, called Learned Optimism, and it's all about the importance of the public learning about the positive side of psychology and how to attain positive behaviors, exercise, and positive thinking and relationships, so that the neuronal connections, the patterns in the brain, are predominantly positive and not negative. So I hope that answers your question. It's a very interesting idea that there are permanent changes, and true. We have to change our thinking to change those brain processes.
I've got the proper spelling here: DYSTHYMIA. And I guess I want to talk about how depression can sometimes be a source of creativity. A lot of writers, artists, musicians openly talk about their depression and use their depression as a form of self-exploration and expression in a successful way.
Oh, I'm smiling because some of the nicest, I don't take gifts as a psychologist, but I don't take material gifts, but I can't even tell you how many creative things my patients have done for me. They've written poems, they've framed them, they've drawn pictures, they've done all these things, and I'm touched by them. Some hang on my wall. I really value them. Poetry, stories, but a lot of that stuff goes away when people feel better. Instead of sitting alone at home creating, they're out engaged in the world with other people and too busy working and enjoying the company of others to sit around and write sometimes miserable, sometimes happy themed works of art. So that's true.
You're hearing from Dr. Bruce Lees, a psychologist in the Department of Family Medicine at KU Medical Center. This is Central Standard on KCUR. We're going to hear now from John. John, welcome to Central Standard.
Good morning. Look, I got the person I live married to, they have a highly responsible professional position, okay? They function very well, but we may as well throw away Saturdays, okay? I mean, there's nothing. I mean, she just goes somewhere, and I don't want to describe it, you know, any real negative terms or anything, but she's getting, she's better, but is the symptoms, can they be episodic like this?
Yeah, I think what you're saying is that she functions fine at work during the week, but on Saturdays just kind of goes to sleep or sits in front of the television or goes
checks out.
What has happened in the past is she'll go back to the bedroom, close the curtains, and watch Lifetime.
Right, right.
And that's it, all day.
Well, this gives me an opportunity to talk about the role of identity in mood regulation or emotion regulation. You know, to the extent that we know who we are and we determine ways of becoming the person we want to be, to that extent, we do really well in life and we don't get depressed. That's excluding people who get biologically depressed. But if a person knows their job and knows their career well and thinks they're doing well at it and really throws everything they have into it, they may do well all week. And when that identity is no longer valid because they're home for the weekend, they're supposed to now be a spouse or a girlfriend or a boyfriend or whatever. If you've only really formed satisfactorily one part of your identity, when that's pulled away because it's the weekend, I think the opposite is commonly true. I think people come home often and they're in a great mood on the weekend, and then they're really blue and down and despairing throughout the week when they have to go to work. So I think that's really what you're looking at. But my hope is, John, that you talk to your partner and say, what's going on? What can we do so that you feel like Saturday's the best day of the week for you?
Yeah, noticing those signs and then actively taking a step to seek treatment is what you're...
That's right.
We're going to hear from Mario in Shawnee. Mario, welcome to Central Standard. Good morning. Mario, are you with us? Looks like we lost him, but he was going to ask about the connection between sleep and depression. So often it's mentioned that people sleep too much or not enough. And it's kind of the same thing with eating too much or not enough. I mean, they're totally different, but what's going on when we're depressed that these things like sleeping and eating can kind of be in this almost a manic state?
Yesterday, I went through the day in physical pain. Everything hurt. My eyes hurt. Everything hurt. Because my plane landed at midnight at KCI, and my first patient was at 7 o'clock in the morning, and I live an hour away from the clinic. It takes an hour to get in from the airport. I had around 4 hours of sleep. It felt horrible. It made me think of what depressed people must feel like. So sleep, it's a cyclic process there again. Sleep is important for mood regulation, for concentration, for general functioning, for reaction time. That's why pilots are required to sleep so many hours before they fly. Depression tends to disrupt sleep, and then sleep problems tend to exacerbate depression. So it's a terrible cyclic process. I got 8.5 hours sleep last night. I feel great today. So you raise a very important question. Sleep hygiene, as it's called, is a really important part of the care of anybody who has emotional problems. And it's one of the vegetative symptoms. I used the word vegetative earlier. If a person's sleep doesn't get under control, often with medication, it's going to be really hard for them to function effectively and be not depressed.
And can we briefly talk about the role of food too then?
Yeah, I mean, if food includes things like caffeine, yes. I don't eat much salt, and if I consume foods with too much salt, I'll wake up. What will wake me up in the night is you know, the dry mouth you feel when you're really, really thirsty in the middle of the night. I can imagine, I'm not a big sweets eater, but I imagine that anything that your body has to work on all night besides the process of sleep probably messes with your sleep. So I don't know the details, but I think you're onto something there.
We're about out of time, but I want you to talk quickly about the resources that are out there. The more and more you learn about depression, they say that it's important to talk about it in an open way and make sure that resources are available for people who are seeking treatment. And you have some resources that you'd like to share with us?
Yes. Most people go to the internet for research on common things like depression. And I would first and foremost advise people when they get on a search engine looking for answers to questions about depression and other mental problems that they really they look for websites that have an EDU at the end of it for education, like KUMC.edu is KU's address. But the National Institute, National Institute of Mental Health, NIMH.org, if you want to learn more. WebMD, the Mayo Clinic.com, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, NAMI, N-A-M-I, I think it's .org. So looking up a .org or a .edu is wise because those are organizations, not-for-profits usually, or educational institutions. If you have insurance, if you have coverage for medical care, that coverage usually includes mental health problems and local county mental health centers. And, of course, you can come to KU Med.
Well, we'll have a link of all those resources on our website that you can access at kcur.org. We're out of time. I want to thank our guest, Dr. Bruce Leese. He's a psychologist at KU Medical Center. Bruce, a pleasure as always.
It is my pleasure to work with you. Thanks.
Tune in tomorrow for Central Standard as we nuzzle into the influential lives of our feline companions. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and myself. Our intern is Claire McInerney. Up to Date is next with a mother and son who hiked across Kansas and some essays about mothers. I'm Suzanne Hogan, and this is Central Standard on KCUR. Enjoy the day.